The following program is brought to you by Podcast One Sportsnet.
This episode of the Steve Austin Show is brought to you free in part by our friends at GEICO. Go to geico.com and in 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. That's right, save hundreds of dollars on car insurance at geico.com. Extra money in your pocket? It may just be the most rewarding thing you do today.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
All right, everybody, welcome to Steve Austin Show. I am coming to you from the command center at the Broken Skull Ranch 2.0 out here in the Silver State. I'm over here in Nevada. I'm in my little office out here in my shop, and I got a little heater running. It's kind of chilly out here in Nevada, and I got a couple of furniture pads down on the ground. I got my Kawasaki rug and a dog bed. Callie's sleeping on one side, and over here underneath a couple of deer heads, Mula is snoring her fool head off. And I got a bunch of Pearl Beer memorabilia in here, some Lone Star stuff, another neon clock, so secondhand spin around like a rotisserie chicken in here. My wife and I have been slowly migrating more and more stuff out here to Nevada from L.A. because this is all stuff that was in storage anyway, so I have plenty of storage facility out here. So I've been moving it, and I was in my closet the other day in my office, and I noticed this briefcase. And this was a briefcase I brought probably in 1990. It had to be 1990. And I brought the little pile of shit, shitty aluminum briefcase. If you had any money, or if you were somebody, you were carrying around a Halliburton. Well, I wasn't anybody, and I didn't have any money, so I didn't buy the Halliburton. I brought the cheap imitation copy. And so I looked in this briefcase, and I don't know how long. And I said, man, let me see what is in there. I opened up that briefcase, and you remember in Pulp Fiction when Samuel L. Jackson and John Travolta, they kept having that briefcase. And when they opened it up, it just shined a bunch of gold out of there. Well, there wasn't none of that shit in my briefcase, but what there was a couple of old magazines and just a bunch of 4x6, 5x7, whatever they are, pictures from way back in the day. Some when I first started my wrestling career. A lot of these made the magazines, and the photographers at the time would just give me the pictures. And, man, I'm lucky to have them because half this shit I forgot about. And it brought back so many memories. And one of the things that fell out of the Austin 316 edition of the magazine was a booking sheet from the USWA. So what I'm going to do here for the podcast is I'm in my office, got my dog sleeping, I got the neon going. I've got a bunch of pictures laid out on a table in front of me, and I've gotten my iPhone. I took some pictures of these pictures I got laid out. I'll post them on my Instagram account. So as I go through some of these pictures, you can see what the hell I'm talking about, because they always say a picture's worth 1,000 words. And when I started looking at some of these pictures, I said, you know what? There's got to be a podcast here, because I'm sure I've talked about every picture I'm going to talk about, but specifically I'll go through each picture and just some of the good times, the bad times, the high times, and the low times of my career. Now, I don't see any pictures of me bleeding like a stuck pig from when I was working with Bret Hart, who was instrumental in my career. I don't see a picture of the Undertaker and myself when, man, the matches we had, Highway to Hell, when he dropped that leg off that top turnbuckle. But there's a lot of other big matches that I don't have any pictures of. A lot of my stuff with Triple H or Mick Foley, some of those things aren't here. So I'm not forgetting anybody that I ever worked with. I'm just working off some of the names on this booking sheet here and the pictures that I found in this briefcase. And as I started thumbing through some of these pictures, I was like, man, what a damn good time I had in the business of professional wrestling. And I was so thankful that it just seems like my whole life, I guess I was supposed to be a pro wrestler, because that's all I ever wanted to be. As soon as I saw the business on television when I was 7 or 8 down there in Edna, Texas. And then, you know, a pivotal moment would have been when I finished playing football at Wharton County Junior College in about 85. And I was going to get 2 scholarship offers to continue playing college football and continue my college education. And I could have gone to University of New Mexico, or I could have gone to North Texas State University. And I chose North Texas State University. And that university is in Denton, Texas, which is 30 miles from the world-famous Sportatorium way back in the day, when that's where world-class championship wrestling was kind of on a decline from its white hot days as one of the number one wrestling promotions in the world. Right when I signed on or came through Chris Adams Wrestling School, Jerry Jarrett had bought an interest in that territory. Eric Embry was booking the Texas part of the territory, and they had to change the name from World Class Championship Wrestling to United States Wrestling Association, which made a lot of people pretty mad. But nonetheless, a bunch of these pictures I'll go through and start talking about them right now. And before I get on the podcast and start running my mouth, I want to say thanks to everybody who sent me some suggestions as far as the musical stuff to listen to. I've been wearing the hell out of Cody Jinks' Adobe Sessions album. Man, that What Else Is New, Mama Song, Ready for Things to Get Better, Dirt, David. Damn, that whole album is nothing but pure platinum. So if you get a chance, go check out that Cody Jinks album. That guy can sing his ass off. And if you watch his guitar player, I think I'm getting him right, at least his current guitar player. I think his name is John Wallace. He plays the Fender Telecaster. The tone he gets out of that damn guitar, some of the licks he's playing, some of the stuff that he's doing, and most of the stuff I've seen, he's not running a steel guitar. Cody Jinks isn't behind him. I'm sure he's played with one, but I'm just watching this John Wallace guy, just a solid-ass band, and damn what a lead guitar player. Shit. And the songs that Cody Jinks writes, that Mama Song's probably, I wear that damn thing out. I put that damn thing in the house, and my wife just starts shaking her head because she says, "You are the only person I know that can listen to a song over and over and over again." And I just smiled. That's what I do. Anyway, coming right back, we'll talk about all these pictures that I've got laid out on the table. I'm going to talk to you about what was going on at the time, what was running through my mind. And again, the good times, bad times, high times, low times of a damn good time and a hell of a career in the business of pro wrestling. I'm coming right back. Moolah's asleep. Kyla's asleep. I'm here in my office. I got a bunch of neon going. It's going to be a good podcast. Stay tuned. Hey, if you or a loved one suffer from leg or foot cramps, you know how painful and disruptive they can be. Muscle cramps can jolt you out of a sound sleep or interrupt your daily life. Well, check it out, because I'm about to get you hip to TheraWorks Relief. A non-greasy foam is proven to relieve muscle cramps fast and reduce muscle soreness. With daily use, TheraWorks Relief can even prevent muscle cramps before they start, so you can get a full night's sleep or do the activities you love. TheraWorks Relief only takes minutes to apply, absorbs quickly, and it works. People love the results. You've probably seen Dr. Drew Pinsky on TV putting TheraWorks Relief over. It is that efficient and respected. The holiday season is around the corner, so if you know someone who suffers with muscle cramps or muscle soreness, get them TheraWorks. TheraWorks Relief is the top choice for preventing and relieving muscle cramps. Get TheraWorks Relief today in the pain relief aisle at Walmart, CVS, Rite Aid, and Walgreens, or by talking to your pharmacist. Learn more at TheraWorksRelief.com. That's TheraWorksRelief.com. Check it out.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Steve Austin Show. I am standing here in the office of my shop, the command center, as I call it here, at the BSR 2.0. Hell, man, I got a workbench in front of me. I got about 75 4x6, 5x7 pictures strung out on the table, bringing back a shit pile of memories back from the day. And I've tried to do this podcast right now 20 times, minimum 20 times. Sometimes I'll get 5 minutes in. The furthest I've made it is 28 minutes in. And then all of a sudden I'll get on a ramble and I'll say, "Dude, what the F are you talking about? You got nowhere to go. Start over." And I just hit the stop button and start over. So there's so many years that are laid out in front of me. And it's not everything that happened in my career, but it's a big part of it. And it was just in that briefcase that I pulled down out of that closet and brought down here. Hell, I'll start with the summage right here. Here's a picture of me. Yours truly. Long blonde hair. Good looking kid. No facial hair. Semi-white teeth. White wrist tape on my wrists. Holding the Pro Wrestling Illustrated 1990 Rookie of the Year Award. And I got some paramecium amoeba psychedelic long tights on. I don't know what inspired my early in-ring gear. I just thought that multicolored shit in 89-90, chicks in New York are paying top dollar for this shit. I was getting it pretty damn cheap. I just thought it was a pretty cool look. And so I started off in long tights, ended up cutting those into like bicycle length shorts, and then went to trunks. But that's what I started off in. I'm looking at this picture. 1990 Rookie of the Year. It brings back a lot of memories for me. And the reason I won the Rookie of the Year, I don't think I was probably the best wrestling talent of the year, but it was due to the fact that Gentleman Chris Adams picked me, his prize student coming out of the Gentleman Chris Adams Wrestling Academy, to work a high-profile angle with him. And this was, you know, Eric Emery was booking Texas. Jerry Jarrett had just bought out Fritz Von Erich. World-class championship wrestling became United States Wrestling Association. And so Chris was able to book our angle, run it by Eric, and everything was cool. But it was due to the fact that it was a high-profile angle, student versus teacher. I'd only been working for a couple of months when I got in this feud, so if you go back and watch some of that stuff, I was greener than shit. But I'll never forget when Bill Apter called me, and he goes, "Steve, you won the Rookie of the Year for 1990. I think it was a pretty close vote. I can't remember who came in second place. And so you always think, man, the wrestling business is a work. Everything's a work. But to some degree, it's a shoot. And you live and die by these things. You really do as a performer. And so I was so proud to be the Pro Wrestling Illustrated Rookie of the Year for 1990. And Chris Adams, he's no longer with us. But he really put me on the map. And me and Chris had a very interesting relationship because Chris was a very charismatic guy. He was a great teacher, judo background, but he had a wild side. And I didn't know much of his wild side because in my formative years, in my younger years, we never really hung out at all. He did his thing. When all the guys were working in Dallas, I was living in Denton. And I had a girlfriend at the time, so I would just go back home. I never partied with the guys. I never hung out with the guys. I just showed up, got the shit kicked out of me at the Sportatorium on Friday nights or Saturday mornings, and then, you know, went back to work at Watkins Motor Lines, driving my forklift on Monday and put my 40 to 60 hours in. So I wasn't hanging with nobody, but Chris was an interesting guy, and he had his demons. He had his evil side. And he met his demise, got shot. I don't know the story behind that by a dude named Boo Ray. But Scott Casey was originally going to train me to get into the business of pro wrestling. And then I fell out of touch with him. I saw the commercial for the Chris Adams Wrestling School, and that's how I got into business. You've heard me tell that story or parts of that story many times. Looking at myself here, long blonde hair, pretty white teeth, blue eyes. Blonde hair was kind of stringy. White wrist tape, good-looking, blue-chip kid. Little did I know what the future had in store for me with respect to life on the road and the business of pro wrestling. Looking up towards my wall, I got some pictures of me working in WCW, and I'm wearing the same multicolored tights that I wore in the USWA, except they're not long tights anymore. They're bicycle-length tights. And I just decided, okay, let's get out of this. Let's change into something new and wear shorts. And so I did. I got my hair drawn back in a ponytail. This is before I had to start cutting it off, before I started losing it. And I just see these pictures of a guy who's in a transformation process. And so to the people down there at the NXT Performance Center or anybody on the indie scene or trying to get into business, your first look will probably not be the look that you go through for the rest of your career. You're going to go through changes. You're going to experiment. You're going to succeed. You're going to fail. But through all of this process, you're going to find out who and what you are. When I look at the long-haired guy that got broke into the business, wasn't even smartened up before my first match, got a run down there in WCW, turned into the world television champion, supposed to get a damn U.S. title run with one of the greatest of all time, Harley Race, got that yanked out from under me, started a tag team with some guy named Flying Brian Pillman, who I had admired from afar because he was a good-looking guy and a hell of a damn worker. All of a sudden, we're in a tag team. We turn into the Hollywood Blondes, start experimenting with all his ring gear. You're going to go through all these transformations in your career, and you should face them just headstrong, face first, just like you're walking through a bunch of wind. I mean, be willing to adapt and be willing to change. Speaking of change, I'm sitting there looking at a picture right now of me with my hands on my hip, kind of a trademark pose. I got a red and black sequin robe. It says SS on the back for Stunning Steve. And a lady in Dallas, Texas made this robe for me at my request. And I remember she got busted for shoplifting, spent a couple days in jail and putting this robe together. A robe like this today would set you back probably, I don't know, $2,500, $1,500 maybe. This robe was supposed to be designed in the vein of a Ric Flair robe. But holy smokes, the workmanship, the quality of materials, the design, nothing was near what the Nature Boy Ric Flair was wearing. His were the greatest of all time. They were phenomenal. I paid $150 for this red and black robe. I still have it to this day. I'll never forget it. I remember walking to the ring in this damn thing. Sometimes in WCW, I'd be walking down with Ravishing Rick Rude. And when you looked at me, who was a guy who was going through the phases, and looking at a guy like Rick Rude, who had already had his WWF run, was a polished, finished product, and an amazing body, and an amazing bumper, and an amazing psychologist, and an amazing worker. There's no comparison. He outshined me. But that was the phase that I was going through. Here I am again. World television champion. Championship belt draped over my right shoulder. Left hand is on my hip. The guy beside me to my left is none other than Pauline Dangerously. The guy that, for some reason, we just became friends in WCW. Rode down the road together. Taught me a lot back in those days. And then when I got fired, he was the first guy that hired me when I went down to ECW. And that is where I learned to cut a promo. Still going through the metamorphosis, the changes, as far as what I would ultimately end up looking like. Hell, just thinking right now off the top of my head, I went back to long tights at that phase of my career. I was a superstar, Steve Austin, working with the Sandman and Mikey Whipwreck. And I'll never forget cutting that promo down at the bottom of that hotel at 4:30 in the morning with Paul Lee. And Paul Lee was the first guy to call me once I tore that tricep off my arm and got fired and said, "Hey, man, come to work for me." And I said, "Man, I can't work. I got a busted arm." He goes, "You ain't got to work. Cut promos." Sounded like a good idea at the time because I needed the money. And there I went, continuing the process, continuing the transformation, continuing to absorb, watch, learn, love, eat, sleep, shit, the business. Wasn't there too long. Finally got the third call that I'd gotten from Vince McMahon. Telephone rang at my log cabin. I got a picture in my hands right now. It's black and white. I got a buzz haircut. I still got a few eyebrows left. Everybody says, "Hey, man, how come you don't have eyebrows? Do you shave them?" No, I don't shave my effing eyebrows. I just ain't got them because I'm kind of half-assed bald, if you haven't noticed. Receding hairline, male pattern baldness. Yeah, I got it. So I got this $1 million championship belt in my hand. I got, you can't see it in the picture, but they're emerald green trunks. Ted DiBiase was my manager. I'll never forget talking to Vince. He gave me that sales pitch in that log cabin in Georgia. Sounded like a good idea at the time. Shit, Ted DiBiase is my manager. I watched Ted from Mid-South Power Pro Wrestling. He was awesome. A great talker. Hellacious worker. What a hand. He's going to be my manager? Cool. Turns out I was a deaf mute. Didn't get a chance to talk. Vince had noticed me for my work, for my promos in ECW, but he wasn't ready for me to talk yet. As I was a ringmaster, I'll never forget going to Chicago. They flew me up to Chicago, Illinois, to meet with a couple of seamstresses, Terry Anderson and her sister, Julie Anderson. They probably both have different names by now. Terry ultimately would make all of my ring gear. She made my first pair of trunks. They were emerald green trunks. According to Vince McMahon, they saw me wearing a singlet. I said, "Ain't no way I'm wearing a singlet because I ain't got no amateur wrestling background and homie don't wear no singlet. So I'll go emerald green, but I ain't wearing a singlet." So I go over to Terry's place. Julie's there, whichever one's place it was. We hit it off like gangbusters. At the time, I was chewing Red Man tobacco. At the time, I had an extreme case of bad gas. So every time I needed a fart, I would excuse myself like I had to go out and get some chewing tobacco so I could basically shit my pants and not be embarrassed in front of them. But I struck up a relationship with those ladies, and we continue to be really, really good friends to this day. And Terry was the one who ultimately ended up making all of my ring gear and my jackets. And Julie was making the Undertaker stuff. She was making Shawn Michaels stuff. She might have done Bret Hart stuff too. They both do equally phenomenal work. It's just you get put with a certain superstar and you make their stuff. And Terry Anderson made my stuff. And I'm looking at another Ringmaster picture here, because I'll never forget, I made my debut, and I believe Scotty Too Hotty was my first opponent in the WWF. And it was a get-over match for me. And I remember wearing the emerald green trunks. And because they had no plans for me, I remember asking Vince, I said, "Hey, man, what do you want me to do for ring gear?" He says, "Well, we're going to send you over here." And that's where I got the trunks from. I said, "Well, what about boots?" "Well, just wear the boots you got." Well, the boots I had were the white Hollywood Blonde boots with the black star on them. So there's where I showed up. I got emerald green trunks. I got white boots with a black star on them, and basically nothing else. No vest, no this, no that, no other plans. And I'm looking at this picture right now. I hated those emerald green trunks. I've always liked black. Black is one of my favorite colors. And so I noticed the WWF back then, and now it's WWE, it was a little bit of the Wild Wild West. So when you first go in, you go in under their auspices and their watchful eye, but then you see, okay, they brought you in, but they really ain't got no plans for you. I think you can kind of fudge a little bit and go a little bit in this direction. So I said, okay, I'm going back to my black trunks. I had started wearing black trunks when I was in WCW, went on the back of them because I had been feuding so much with Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, the greatest babyface of all time. I would get black trunks with US Champ on the back, or Dragon Slayer on the back, or whatever, but they were black trunks. So I said, you know what? I'll go back to black trunks. I told Terry Anderson, "Hey man, make me some black trunks." And so then I got a pair of black boots made. I started growing in that goatee. And that's when me and Goldust were traveling together, Dustin Rhodes, we were working Pittsburgh at the Mellon Arena. And I had this Buzz haircut. When I'm looking at this first picture right here, the black and white one, I got that Buzz haircut, no facial hair. Started growing my shit in. And I said, "Man, F it. You can't see my hair. I'm going to go ahead and shave this shit off." So that's what I did. And Dustin said, "Man, what are you doing?" I said, "Man, I'm shaving this shit off." I said, "You can't see it anyway." I said, "It ain't got no business being here." As I'm looking at this picture, this was the beginning of Stone Cold Steve Austin. I got a black knee brace on my right knee. I'm not wearing the one on my left leg yet. I'm holding the $1 million championship in my right hand. I've got my left arm up in the air with the number one going up. I got black wrist tape. I always used to use white wrist tape. And then I got to a period in WCW where I was going completely old school. I was wearing the psychedelic tights, no knee pads, no wrist tape, no elbow pads, no nothing. I was going old school. I said, "F this. All these pads are for sissies. When you jump off that second turnbuckle, much less the third turnbuckle to drop an elbow on somebody or to frog splash somebody and they move or they stay and you're landing on your knees and elbows, you don't do that shit for long." Kevin Nash remembers. We were traveling together. Hell, man, the buildings wasn't even, shit, there might have been 500 people there. And I'm jumping off turnbuckles and shit like that. Kevin Nash will never forget that story. So the change started happening after that Mellon Arena thing, when I shaved that head, started growing that goatee, and the Stone Cold look started coming to be. And that's when I saw that special on HBO about Richard Kuklinski and came up with the Stone Cold Steve Austin idea. I didn't come up with the name. The concept and my ex-wife came up with that name. Before I continue on with the WWE part of my career, there's a couple of Hollywood Blondes pictures right here. Brian with the clapboard. I've got the tag title over my shoulder, white boots, black star, black knee pads, stars on our black trunks, Hollywood Blondes on the back. Here I am, a kneeling pose. both hands raised in the air, silver leather vest, SS on the front for Stunning Steve, 3 stars. Here's another picture of me and Brian going to the ring. Brian's got that charismatic look. We're wearing our black and red kind of felt velvet vest to the ring. I got that short bouffant haircut. I got facial hair shortly cropped. That was one of the best times of my life, teaming with Flying Brian Pillman. And I never, ever wanted to tag team with Flying Brian Pillman, much less anyone else. But there was that day, that fateful day in Dothan, Alabama, at a television taping. I was about to start a singles run as a U.S. champ at Harley Race. Him guiding me. Shit, I'd been up and down the road with Harley Race and big Leon White, Van Vader, when he was a world champion. Harley Race, everybody looked up to that guy. Hell, he damn near jerked my damn head off my neck when he was trying to set my neck one time. And Leon, we could have pulled that car over, and it would have been real interesting to see what would have happened between Leon and Harley after talking to Ric Flair the other day on the podcast. But Leon White wasn't no damn walk in the park. That was a tough, mean son of a bitch. No matter what happened to him at the center stage fight with Paul Orndorff. But those were the days, man. Tag teaming with Flying Brian Pillman, driving down the road in a Chevy Lumina van with Raven, the comedy trio. Brian reading his vocabulary books, trying to increase his vocabulary. And then all of a sudden I get the call and I go to the WWF. Going back, I've digressed. I go back to the Ringmaster pictures. Ringmaster wasn't going nowhere. And there's a picture right here of me pointing my finger at a man named Jacob Snake Roberts, Doc Hendricks, a.k.a. Michael Hayes. All of a sudden, fast forward to a picture from 1996, King of the Ring, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at the Mecca Arena. I'm pointing my finger in this picture back at my opponent, Jake the Snake Roberts. Doc Hendricks, a.k.a. Michael Hayes, part of the Fabulous Freebirds. And I am running Jake the Snake Roberts down. I've just proved, son, without a shadow of a doubt, that you ain't got what it takes anymore. Don't just get him out of the ring. Get him out of the WWF, because I proved without a shadow of a doubt you ain't got what it takes anymore. And I tell him to go buy a cheap bottle of Thunderbird to try to dig back some of that courage he had in his prime. I would go on to say, you sit there and you thump your Bible and say your prayers, and that didn't get you anywhere. Talk about your Psalms. Talk about John 3:16. Austin 3:16 says, I just whooped your ass. I would go on to talk about the championship match between Shawn Michaels and Davey Boy Smith. As I was wrapping up this promo, I needed to button up this promo and go home. I could hear the RF microphone Vince was doing commentary. I knew I needed to shut the F up and take it home, but I needed a button. So as I'm hearing Vince, I'm saying to myself, I need to go home line. I need to go home line. And that's when I shit out. And that's the bottom line, because Stone Cold said so. As a heel in 1996, when King of the Ring, when the only reason I won King of the Ring that year was because of the big breaking kayfabe thing that happened in a cage at Madison Square Garden between the Click. Triple H was supposed to win King of the Ring that year. Triple H didn't. As I was walking across the parking lot in, it was either Lowell or Worcester, Massachusetts. I hear this voice behind me. Yo, Steve, you got a second? It was Vince McMahon. Yes, sir, I do. He says, hey, man, I just want to let you know in 2 weeks you're winning King of the Ring. And I said, okay. I kept carrying my bag into the building and worked TV. So it was a chance opportunity to begin with. I was never designed to win. I was never supposed to win. But when I did win, based on the circumstances that happened, working that first match of that pay-per-view with Mark Merrow, when he does that flippity-flip thing where he kicked me in my mouth and put 14 stitches in my damn lip, well, he didn't. I had to go to the hospital in the middle of the pay-per-view, get stitched up, stayed in my work gear, came back, and got ready to work Jake Snake Roberts in the final. And that's when Doc Hendricks, Michael Hayes, told me that Jake got a religious-based promo on me, and that's when the Austin 3:16 was born. Myself and Jake would have a short match because of my lip. Didn't want to go and do a bunch of damage to it. And if it had not been for Mark Merrow kicking me in the mouth, the Click hugging, and, you know, ruining Triple H's chances, Mark Merrow kicked me in the mouth, Jake the Snake Roberts cutting a religious-based promo on me, Doc Hendricks smartened me up about it upon my arrival back to the building from the ambulance, from the hospital. Austin 316, because Stone Cold said so, would have never been born. There had been no reason for it to ever have been born. It was specific to the task at hand, the story at hand. And it all goes back to when I chose North Texas State over University of New Mexico for my scholarship football. I wasn't going to leave the state of Texas. That put me with close proximity to world-class championship wrestling. And now this kept unfolding. It's like, I don't believe that you're destined for anything in life, but I think some things happen for a reason, and you have to be in the right place in the right time. It's like that old saying, I don't know what it is, when opportunity meets preparation or preparation meets opportunity, whatever happens. It just always seems like everything that I've ever done equates to the fact that I made the right decision in deciding to get into the business of pro wrestling. So all those things happened. And now, after all that, I'm looking at a picture. I'm laying in the middle of a ring. I got a championship belt laying by my head. My left hand is on the mat by my head. My right hand is trying to reach up. The look on my face is pure agony. I'm in a lot of pain. I'm discombobulated, and I am effed up. Kneeling over me with his hands on my traps, checking if I'm okay, is my good friend, Earl Hebner. Meadowlands, New Jersey. Working a match with Owen Hart. We go into a gimmick. I'm going to give him a pile driver. He reverses out of it. Boom, he goes down to his butt. I'm spiked in the mat, and I am a transient quadriplegic for about 60 seconds. I don't know whether to shit or wind my watch. The stipulation in this match is whoever loses has to kiss the other guy's ass. As I'm laying there paralyzed and Owen is over me, I tell him, don't touch me, I can't move. So Owen starts buying time, and Owen is no longer with us. God rest his soul. When you're paralyzed, it is a shitty situation. I can't move shit. My arms are flapping around a little bit, but my legs ain't doing nothing. Jim Ross on commentary. Jerry Lawler on commentary. After about a minute, I call an audible. I've got to finish this match. I tell Earl Hebner, tell Owen Hart, roll up for the win. And Earl goes and tells Owen, schoolboy. And so, because I cannot crawl on my hands, it was an act of damn near a miracle to be able to bend my knees. If you watch it back on YouTube, it's like I was just this rusty crustacean and I cannot move. I roll Owen up with the worst cradle in the history of the business. Davy Boy Smith was livid because I'd exposed the business, but I just wanted out of the match. Hell, I'm trying to get back to the dressing room. Hell, I should be in a damn hospital. I can't believe I'm even doing this. My only instincts were, you started this, you have to finish it. That's the mentality of any ultimate competitor in anything you do. You finish. I didn't think about, hey, man, I'm effed up. I can't move. All I could think about was finish the match. I ain't kissing nobody's ass. You know, I'm on fire. I'm white hot. I'm ascending. I'm going to the top. All of a sudden you get paralyzed. Everything changes. But as I lay there paralyzed, it was like a gong. A big gong was hit. But I stayed razor sharp. I was concussed, no doubt. But my thinking was clear. And as much pain as I was in, I knew I needed to finish. And I did. I go back, and I don't have the pictures from the ring in front of me, but I remember Jimmy Corderas, Timmy White, and Earl Hebner helping me to my feet. And they put my arms around their shoulders for support. And I'm holding the Intercontinental title in one hand. And the lights are on, but nobody's home. And everybody knew it was a botch, and everybody saw the finish because it was see-through as hell. But you've got to acknowledge that crowd. You've got to let them in. And I was like, I got to let them know I'm okay. I got to let them know I registered the win. I understand what's going on. So I grab that belt, and I held it over my head. And they're holding on to me, helping me maintain my balance. And finally, I just drop that belt. And then I go down to my knees and I roll out of the ring and they grab the belt for me. And they put my arms over their shoulders again. And I walk back to the dressing room. If you ever watch that footage back, you can see my left leg dragging heavily behind me. My left side was impacted more so than my right. To this day, my left hand is atrophied. When it gets cold, that left foot starts dragging behind me. And the next picture I'm looking at is backstage at the Meadowlands Arena in New Jersey. I still got my leg braces on, my boots on. I put my shorts on. I put on my gold chain that Brian Pillman got me. Shit, my right wrist tape is still on. I got my watch on. I'm fixing to head to the hospital. The hand that is on top of my head, you can't see him in the picture, but his hand is on my top. But his hand is on my head is Dr. Ramaskavage. He used to always come to the Jersey, Pittsburgh area shows because he was local. And he's trying to calm me down. And as I'm sitting there with my hands on my legs, my elbows on my legs, I've got my head in my right hand. And I am in a world of shit. I am confused. I am in pain. I just damn near got paralyzed for the rest of my life. And I escaped it. And I am highly emotional. There's some tears coming out of my eyes. You can't see in the picture. But what just happened scared the living shit out of me. And my interior delts are on fire. They're burning like someone just rubbed icy hot on them. And my anterior delts would burn for another 2 weeks. I didn't think it'd ever stop. And this is goes hand in hand with blunt force trauma to the top of the head, the number one cause of quadriplegia. When I went and saw Dr. Joseph Torg in Philadelphia, finally it would turn into an itch, and finally it would go away. But I'll never forget, man, looking at this picture, getting loaded up in an ambulance. They didn't put me on a gurney. I just rode to the hospital in an ambulance. Got all x-rayed up. And then I'll never forget, man, I walked outside. I didn't have a ride back to the hotel. And there's three women that had followed the ambulance to the hotel. I didn't know them. And they said, Steve, do you need a ride back to your hotel? And I said, yeah, I sure do. And I loaded up. I can't remember. I think we were in a van. And he said, do you want anything? I said, yeah, I'd like a 12-pack of beer. And they stopped by the liquor store because you can't buy beer right there by the hotels the way Philly is down there at the airport. This is back in the day. I got a 12-pack of Budweiser beer, and they walked me to my room. They got me all set up, and they said goodbye, and I said, thank you very much for the ride. And I'm still in a world of shit. I sat there in that bed, dazed and confused and in pain. I drank that 12-pack of beer, and I went to sleep. I remember that we were in Meadowlands, New Jersey that night. Monday Night Raw was in Philadelphia, PA, the next day. Got my rental car, had a soft collar on from my injury. I cut a promo, and after that promo, I was gone for about 3 or 4 months. And I think that was one of my most significant injuries in the business of wrestling, from when I tore my tricep off my right elbow, the ACL, PCL injuries, all the stitches, everything else. But when you get dropped on your head and you turn into a trans quadriplegic, it changes everything. Subsequently, after I came back from this, after I told the doctor it wasn't a shoot, it was a work, and I didn't have to take a pile driver every night, I got cleared 3 or 4 months after this, and I slowly eased back into the squared circle. Before I got back into the squared circle, we would shoot some vignettes. And I got a picture in my hand right now. I'm wearing my black high-tech Magnum boots, black shorts, camouflage shirt, camouflage hat, sunglasses. I still had that earring in my left ear. I'm drinking a Lone Star Light beer. And this is when we were filming those videos at somebody's house. And I was shooting those arrows into those 3D targets with different 8x10 pictures of different people from the WWF who had sent me these so-called get well soon cards and letters and pictures wanting me to come back to the Federation. As I'm looking at this picture, I'm off of work because I got to be off work. My whole life has been basically yanked out from under me. And I got these glasses on, earring going on, goatee. And I'm thinking, man, when am I going to get back to work? Am I going to go back to work? Can I go back to work? Yeah, I did. And I went back to work. Next picture I look at, I believe it's from Fresno, California. I am standing face to face with Iron Mike Tyson. He's wearing a suit. I got cut off jean shorts, a black Austin shirt, and I got two metal birds right in his face. And he is about to push me halfway across the ring. Mister, when he pushed me, he pushed the shit out of me. Mike Tyson is strong as hell. And when he pushed me, I'll never forget all those $100 bills flying out of his suit and all of his handlers grabbing up those $100 bills. And we were in business. And the next picture I got in my hand is Mike Tyson. He's got the double eagle wing belt, championship belt, the world title, right there holding it at chest level. He's wearing a suit. On the right is myself wearing an Austin 316 shirt, and I got a death stare at Mr. WrestleMania, the one and only HBK Shawn Michaels, and he is looking down at me as I look into deep into his soul. This is going to be a damn hell of a match. The match is going to be at WrestleMania 14. I've been in the Federation for a couple years. I got white hot. I got two pictures in front of me. One of them is me and Mike Tyson walking away from the ring, and Mike still got my arm in the air, and I got that World Heavyweight Championship in my right arm. The other picture I got is me on the second rope holding up the double wing belt with two beer cans in my hand celebrating, and this is in Boston, Massachusetts at the Fleet Center. After all the years in the business, probably this is going on year 8. I'm the World Heavyweight Champion for the World Wrestling Federation. All the times I spent paying my dues, learning from all the guys that I've talked about in the podcast. And when you're in WCW and you're competing and you know that the WWF is the major leagues, that's where you want to be. And all of a sudden, I'm with Mike Tyson, a very polarizing figure. Mike was an absolute sweetheart to work with. He's a student of the wrestling game. He knows more about the history of wrestling than most of the guys in the business. That's how big of a fan he is of the business. And so think what you want about him. I saw him in Marina Del Rey about a year ago. We hugged each other. He was going to South Africa to do some work. He was phenomenal. He brought so many outside eyeballs to our business. It's absolutely astounding. The press that we did post-match, pre-match, was magnified tenfold because of the presence of Iron Mike Tyson. The only regret I have was that when I pinned Shawn Michaels, and I have that pin somewhere here, I can't find the picture, but I have that picture, and I am hooking Shawn Michaels' leg deep, and I also have my other hand on his trunks because I wanted to show him the ultimate respect. I was kind of turning baby, but I was still kind of heel, and I wanted to show him proper respect. My only regret is Mike hit that three count a little too fast. It was bam, bam, bam. Whereas if you go back to the Earl Hebner championship count, it's one, two, three. There's a definite cadence to the count. And so as great as Mike Tyson did, I would only say that the three count on that match was just a little bit accelerated.
Alexa isn't the only one with breaking news. Make sure to hang around at the end of this podcast for the latest breaking headlines on the AP News Minute.
The hit podcast Zane's World found a new home on Podcast One.
La Gonzalina. Probably should have corrected that before the show.
World traveler, author, and alcohol aficionado Zane Lamprey is well-learned in the art of embracing a good time as he reviews the best attractions and destinations on the globe.
So we went to Black Market Liquor Bar.
Just tell us what you remember.
That's what I remember.
Check out Zane's World every Tuesday on Podcast One or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
I'm sitting there looking at a section of pictures right now. I'm standing on top of a Coors Light beer truck. I think that was in, if I'm not mistaken, Philly? I could be wrong. But anyway, it's the beer truck. And I got two middle fingers raised in the air. Austin 316 shirt, jeans, camouflage shirt. People always talk about the beer truck. The first 30 gallons were beer, and then it turned to water. I got another picture. This is at Nassau Coliseum. I'm driving the cement truck. There were no marks. There was no lines to hit, no stoppers as far as laying down all the different little levels, all the levers I had to pull to get that cement on live television to go into that convertible Corvette. This is a C4? C5. I think it's C4. Beautiful Corvette with burgundy interior. I wanted to keep the Corvette. We had to fill it with cement and total it out. So there's a picture of that. There's a picture of me driving the Austin 316 monster truck over the hearse. I think this is when The Rock was delivering his eulogy about Stone Cold being gone, and I crushed his limo or his hearse that he had driven up for me. And so it's not all of the vehicles. There's not a Zamboni picture that was here. It's not the monster limo that I drove, and that's not here. But going back to all the vehicles that I drove, I've always been able to grasp or get a handle of the situation, not being an expert at pretty much driving anything on wheels. When they first told me about that monster truck stuff, hey, man, you're going to be crushing The Rock's Lincoln Continental, which they bought brand new off the showroom floor. That son of a bitch was brand new, 30 grand back in the day. Crushing this hearse, driving that cement truck. They just brought this Corvette from a salvage yard. There was nothing wrong with it. Somebody's in damn good condition. Driving that Coors Light truck was the easiest thing. I've always been able to drive everything. And so some of these moments, some of the most iconic moments that they set me up for, some of the situations, you know, that was just awesome booking. That was just awesome riding. And playing to the character that I was, that I lived, that I breathed. And it's who I am. And they played to those strengths, and they put me in those situations. As I look at this monster truck picture, the Austin 316 truck, I'll never forget after I got dropped in my head, which I talked about earlier, I finally had to get fused up. When I got fused up, I was in that soft collar, and then I got into a hard collar. And that's when, you know, hey, I started doing some personal appearances. And I started doing, while I was in the healing process, a lot of monster truck gigs down there in South Texas. In Laredo, shit, we were in Laredo, we did Beaumont, we did Lubbock. We did a lot of shit in Texas. And the guy that owned the monster truck was a guy named Calvin Carrington. Highly respected in the monster truck industry. And I hadn't kept up with Calvin in a long time. And it turns out that Calvin ended up getting killed at a monster truck event when a truck got out of control and a tire basically just crushed him. I want to go into details on it. I apologize to the Carrington family, but yeah, the guy that owns that truck, who was a monster truck veteran and a hell of a guy, super sweetheart of a guy. And I used to go down, I'll never forget, I was down at an event in South Texas one time, and they had didn't show me, or I had neglected to pick up how you shift gears in that thing. And I blew about a $30,000 motor at a monster truck event. And this is when The Rock also had a monster truck that they were running. And they had, you know, I think they switched the motors out or whatever. But I blew the truck up because I revved it too high. And, man, you talk about feeling like a piece of shit. When you blow a guy's high performance, those trucks are running 1,500 to 2,000 horsepower. When you blow one up, they cost a little bit of money to get fixed. So Calvin Carrington, rest in peace. But, man, what a super guy. And it was just a pleasure to do business with that guy and hang out with him and get the chance to drive that awesome Dodge Austin 316 pickup. I got a selection of pictures I'm looking at now. I'm staring face to face with a man they call The Rock. And he's wearing a yellow and black and white zebra stripe silk shirt. And I'm looking at him with my black Austin 316 shirt. Camera guy is right in the background, working an angle, many angles with The Rock. I pick up another picture, and I'm laying on the mat on my belly. My elbows are on the mat, and I've got two middle fingers right up in The Rock's face. And this is what he's still rocking the long sideburns, and he's giving me this look, and it's just intensity. And there's me in the stunner position. We're about 3 feet off the ground. It's myself with a beer can in my left hand. The Rock is on my right shoulder. I'm grabbing him by the back of his neck, and we are midair in the stunner position, and we are about to come crashing down. And as we come crashing down, Rock's going to take that bump, and he's going to flip-flop and fly all over the place. A lot of people called it the oversell. Hell no, that wasn't no oversell. That was big time. That was showtime. That was showmanship. Hell, The Rock's the biggest actor in the world right now. He's the biggest box office draw. This was, you know, kind of like the telltale sign of things to come. Rock was an awesome opponent. I got this picture right here. It's me, and I've got a look of grit and determination on my face. I'm walking down to the ring. I'm walking down to the ring for my last time because it's WrestleMania 19 in Seattle, Washington. That ramp is so long, it'll damn near blow you up. It'll almost take you out of your rhythm because the walk is so long, you're usually used to a shorter walkway. So, you know, what, 50, 60 yards all of a sudden becomes 150 and you're going through your routine, you're cussing. It's like, God damn, when am I going to get there? When am I going to get there? And finally, you're there. There I am on the top turnbuckle, second turnbuckle, rather. I got the OMR vest, the one more round, SCSA. The night before, I'd been spent in the hospital. They were doing all kinds of tests on me. They put four fluids of liquid back into me. I was severely dehydrated. I was drinking too much alcohol, drinking too much caffeine, running myself way too hard. And they never really cleared me for that match. But that was a match where I was going to do the favors for The Rock. And there wasn't no way anybody's going to keep me out of that match. And the next picture I got here, Earl Hebner standing right there in the corner. It's me and The Rock, the great one. I still got my vest on. I don't remember that match much. I don't watch it because it wasn't the greatest match we ever had. And I love 17 with The Rock. I love 15 with The Rock. But this was a match where, shit, when we went in this thing, because I'd spent all night in the hospital, I was dehydrated. I wasn't really medically cleared to get back in that ring. This is on me. This is on me. This ain't WWE. It's on me. I was going to work that night and there wasn't nobody going to stop me. Shit, I didn't know what the F was going to happen. If I could even make it through the damn match. But I did, and I had a good time doing it. And I'm glad I made it through it. But that was the last match that I ever would have. And I've ridden off into the sunset, and I'm happy with that. Respect to The Rock. I'm looking over here on the right-hand side of my picture selection. Another picture, I got my handcuffs behind my back. I'm being escorted by police officers, security guards. I am used to being arrested on live TV. And it was always a blast to work with the cops because anytime we'd go do some of those gigs, the cops were working security. And I have many friends of mine that are law enforcement officers. And I've made friends with a lot of the police officers here in the area that I live in Nevada. And they would always like to hear wrestling stories. And I always liked to used to hear police stories. So they'd tell me about arrest and stuff that they'd been through. And I'd tell them about traveling and this, that, or whatever. So it was always a kick in the ass, a fun kick in the ass to get arrested because those guys treated us like gold. And then, you know, when you get arrested by the cops, as far as from a television standpoint, if you get arrested by the cops and you're doing something wrong, well, that ain't no good. But we had so much fun together. And that so cemented the Stone Cold Steve Austin anti-authority character because I was going against the wishes of a Vince McMahon. It played into the storyline. So shout out to all the cops and the guys that arrested me and the security guards. It was a blast. And in looking at all these pictures, I'm looking at a picture of the very first time I stunned Vince McMahon. Was at Madison Square Garden? And he started flopping around like a crappie. A crappie is a fish. And you put it on the pier and just starts flopping around. He has his eyes wide open. And he's giving this oversell. And here's a picture where we're, I think it's when we're leading up to St. Valentine's Day Massacre. He's grabbing me with his right hand by the face. And I told him, I said, man, grab me by the face and just, I just told him, I said, that's the ultimate, to grab a guy like that and just shit talk him is the ultimate humiliation. And he grabs me by the face, and Vince McMahon is an intense individual. And so am I when we're in an angle. And I'm staring a death dagger in this son of a bitch, and he's doing the same to me, but he's got me in a compromised situation. His guys have got my arms and legs held. I can't do nothing. I am at his mercy, and he has given me the business. Damn, what a fun time that was. Right below that picture, I am just about to crack him in the head with a stainless steel bedpan. And that sumbitch ricocheted the sound. Everybody remembers that. I beat on his leg. He had a hurt left he had a hurt left foot in this angle, so I started pounding his left foot, which would be the dastardliest thing to do to a guy, just pick on a weak body part. So I started beating on his foot and then grabbed that bedpan. And at the end, I stuck an enema tube up his ass, allegedly. There's a picture below that where, I don't know if this was in Chicago when he fired me or whatever, I got him popping a wheelie in his wheelchair, and I'm pushing him back up the ramp. There's another picture below that. He's at the announce table. Jerry the King Lawler is to his left, and to Lawler's left is the one and only Jim Ross. And I got my middle finger stuck right in Vince's face by about 2 feet. And he's looking at me like, you son of a bitch. I go to another picture, and this is in, was this the build-up to Philly in 15, or was this in Philly when I drove that Coors Light truck? Vince McMahon is on his hands and knees. Shane is in the background. Rock is not in the picture. And this is when Vince starts swimming like a fish because I'm squirting him down with this damn beer. And it's the oversell deluxe. It's what I love about Vince. We'll go to the nth degree to make a damn angle work, to make everything pay off, to bring the crowd the satisfaction that it has desired from the get-go of the angle. Vince will do anything. That's why I love the guy, because I, too, will do anything to pay off that audience for joining in and signing up for the ride. And it is done with conviction and 120% belief. And then here we are, WrestleMania 17, largest attendance in the Astrodome ever. They said George Strait beat our record. I do not believe that to be true. And I have the ultimate respect for George Strait because he's my all-time favorite. We have the all-time attendance record in the Astrodome. And after that incredible match, 25, 28 minutes with The Rock, we lit that place up in WrestleMania 17. Everybody on that crew got off. There wasn't one bad match on that damn whole show. Everybody just absolutely crushed it. And then finally, the main event comes out there, as The Rock would say, finally, the main event comes out there. And we ripped the roof off that sumbitch. And here's a picture of me, which is blood running down my face, shaking hands with the devil himself, Vince McMahon. I turned heel that night. I believe we're in Fort Worth or Dallas the next night. Things didn't go well for me. People didn't want to boo me. That was the night that I wanted to turn heel. And what a match it was, and Rock would go off and head into Hollywood and turn into the biggest movie star of all time. And I go down to another picture. This is from Nashville, Tennessee. And this is when, this is when I was a heel. It was after the show, and I started talking trash to a lot of people that were sitting ringside. And I was talking to him, hey, man, what do you do? One guy was a student. And I said, if there's one thing I can't stand is a sorry-ass student. And then another guy was a truck driver. And I said, if there's one thing I can't stand, it's a sorry-ass truck driver. And then finally, I asked this young lady on the front row. She's wearing a red maroonish type shirt. And her name was Stacy. I said, what's your name? She said, Stacy. I said, Stacy, what do you do for a living? She said, I work for a Christian publishing company. when you're a heel and you get hit with that one, I mean, you cannot rag that, right? So I said, if there's one thing I can't stand, and when I said that, I just flipped the microphone over my right shoulder and started laughing. And the whole crowd popped. And there's a picture of Stacy, and she's clapping her hands and she's laughing her ass off. And the guy beside her is laughing her ass off. I'm laughing my ass off. If I'm not mistaken, that's Marty running the camera on the right side of the picture. He's laughing his ass off. It was the pop heard around the world, but, you know, you can't go heel on somebody in that moment. And although I was trying to be a heel, at some point you got to let it go and you got to laugh and have fun. And I'll never forget that night. That lady was so cool. The guy beside her was cool. And it was just one of those good moments. And then as I look down at some of these other pictures, a lot of pictures of me signing pictures with fans. I got a picture here with me with Frank Smallwood from Virginia. Frank has been one of my biggest fans. He's followed me to a lot of events and been all over the place. I give a shout out to Frank Smallwood. We'll give a shout out to Christine, some of the people that have been there for a long time. And here I'm signing a picture for a kid, and his mother is with him. She's got the son and two kids. Way back in my formative years, wearing a Raw as War cap. A lot of pictures here with military. It's always cool to do stuff with the military. Going overseas one time myself, I know WWE goes damn near every year, signing autographs at the NHRA event when we was running the Austin 316 funny car. That was a blast. So many different moments here. Shit, man, this picture of me. I'm laying down on the mat and I'm selling my ass off, grabbing my right leg, sending a knee brace, selling my ass off. All the good times. Here's a couple of pictures of my 1998 Chevy pickup truck, which I had all about a $3,500 sound system in. Sam, my pit bull that I rescued in South Georgia's in the back. Me and Sam, I put him in the back of that truck. Man, that dog used to love to ride. But the last picture I got here that was in that damn briefcase, it's me with a suit on, a suit and a tie, and I got my right fist extended in the air, and on my ring finger, my right fist, is my WWE Hall of Fame ring. I think I was in Houston. My mother and my father came to see me get inducted into the Hall of Fame. I think a couple of my brothers and my sister came as well. One of the proudest moments of my life for my parents to come over. A couple of my friends came too, to see me get inducted to the Wrestling Hall of Fame for WWE. I call it wrestling because that's what it is. My mom and dad only got a chance to come to a couple of my matches. And I'll never forget when I first started watching wrestling, you know, that first night there when I was 7 or 8 years old, when I believe it to be Dusty Rhodes bleeding in the ring, my mom was reading her magazine. She wasn't watching wrestling, but I was. And I was captivated. And for them to always support me in everything that I did, you know, they were always at every single football game. They were always at every single track meet. They were everywhere. And for them to finally be there when I got to the WWE Hall of Fame, that was pretty damn cool. But anyway, there's a bunch of pictures on this table. I think I talk about most of them. Here's one. I got a big-ass deer, it's a white-tailed deer, in the back of my buddy's pickup truck. Cotulla, Texas, LaSalle County, down there in South Texas. I was wearing camo back when camo wasn't cool. It was a fashion statement for some people. It was a lifestyle for me, hunting down there with my buddy Trey Tindall. Big-ass deer. Lucky to cross paths with my buddy Trey Tindall because that's where I got Hershey the Wonder Dog from. She was a year and a half old when I bought her from Trey Tindall. And that dog was the canine love of my life. Me and that dog was thick as thieves. As much as I love Sam and Shona and Brio and Mula and Callie, all our dogs, for some reason, Hershey and I were just super tight. When I picked up my keys, if I grabbed a gun, if I made a move to go out of the house down at the Broken Skull Ranch, Hershey got up and she was ready to go. When I couldn't find a deer, she taught herself how to track deer. And when one ran off, I would follow Hershey. I would pick her ass up and take her into the deer stand with me. She couldn't see over the windows. She would lay there and sleep. But when I shot something, she would be the first one to be out there tracking it. Anyway, this is an audio podcast. I realize that you cannot see what I'm talking about, but I can go back and look at these memories, reflect upon these memories, and think about what a career I had, how much fun I had, and how much, you know, love and respect I got for the men and women doing the business today, and always love to be able to help them out. They'll always be willing to change. Know that where you start is not where you're going to finish. Learn the system. Learn the pay scale. Learn the work. Learn the crowd. Enjoy your life. Enjoy your downtime. There's going to be a little bit of it. Most time you can be on the road. But as I look at these pictures, and I've been gone from the squared circle for 15 years, going on 19, I had the time of my life. I don't live in the past, but because I dug up that damn briefcase and opened it up, I'm talking about the past. We're about to roll into 2019. I'm looking forward to it. I'm hoping that 2019 is a shit pile better than 2018. As I look at this last picture, it's a picture from the ring. I'm sitting on my ass in the turnbuckle. My right leg is in front of me, straight out. My left leg is bent. I got a leg brace on my left leg, knee pad on my right leg, black boots, black knee pads, black trunks, arms in the turnbuckles on the ropes. My eyes are closed. I'm laid back in pain. I'm bleeding like a stuck pig, and I am in absolute heaven. That's what the wrestling business is for me. I'm coming back to close this show down. Thanks for listening. All right, man, let me give a shout out to my main man, Diamond Dallas Page and DDP Yoga. Still doing my regular workouts with the DDP Yoga Now app for a long time, and I am definitely feeling a change, and it really is for the better. I'm more limber, I'm more loose than ever before, and I feel fantastic. And if you weren't already aware, DDP Yoga has transformed the lives of legends such as Mick Foley and Chris Jericho, who's still going strong at 47, as well as helping rehab injuries for WWE superstars like Bobby Fish, Drew McIntyre, and AJ Styles. DDP Yoga can work for all ages, weights, and fitness levels. It's a kick-ass cardio workout that will dramatically increase your flexibility and strengthen your core like never before, all with minimal joint impact. Just for listeners of the Steve Austin Show and just in time for the holiday season, DDPY is offering its biggest discount ever with 30% off all DDP workouts and the DDP Yoga Now app. And to boot, you will still get 3 months free on the app with any DVD program purchase or 7 days free on any app subscription. DDPY's huge holiday sale is the perfect chance to get started with the program before the new year. This offer is only available at ddpyoga.com/Austin. And check this out, DDP's upcoming book, Positively Unstoppable, The Art of Owning It, is now available for pre-order. Filled with lessons from Paige's life and shares his own struggle to find his calling, overcoming one obstacle after another, Positively Unstoppable is a Bible for anyone who needs to be re-inspired to follow their dreams and take real action towards the things that matter most to them. Positively Unstoppable will be released January 15, 2019, and is available for pre-order anywhere books are sold. All right, everybody, give me the go-home cue so I'm going to wrap up this podcast and ride off in the sunset. But before I do that, I want to remind you that I have the best damn IPA on the planet. It's called Broken Skull IPA from El Segundo Brewing Company. You can find Broken Skull IPA at Whole Foods and Total Wines if you live in Cali. If you ain't in Cali, you're probably shit out of luck. And if you're looking to get a badass pocket knife, this is the holiday season. The Cold Steel Broken Skull Knife and the Cold Steel Working Man Knife. Find them at my new Amazon store. Amazon's got the best price on both knives. Just go to amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin or go directly to the Cold Steel Knives website. I want to say one more thank you to all the fine sponsors of the Steve Austin Show, especially Geico, TheraWorks, DDP Yoga, and TrueCar. That's how I'm able to do this podcast for you twice a week for free. Please support them because they support us. If you need more info on my sponsors, check out the show description to this episode for details. Folks, I am on social media. Twitter and Instagram at Steve Austin BSR. Until next time, my name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
This has been a Podcast One production. Download new episodes of The Steve Austin Show every Tuesday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.
Before we ride off, a quick message from our friends at True Car. Every car comes with its share of stories. That ding in your bumper when you nervously picked up a first date, or the mileage you saved by riding your bike all summer. While you can't put a price tag on your stories, now with True Car, you can at least find out what your car is worth when it's time to sell or trade it in. Just go to True Car. Simply enter your license plate number and watch how your car's details pop up. Then just answer a few questions. Navigation, moonroof, high mileage. Now you know how much it's going to cost you so you can plan ahead. Once you finish, you'll get a true cash offer sent in minutes, which you can take to a local certified dealer to cash out or trade in. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out True Car today. True cash offer not available in all states.